Americans for the Arts.
Good morning. Welcome to True Talk. Ahmed must be held up in traffic, so please listen to this song in the meantime.
Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. Samar is not in the studio. She is traveling. And on today's program, we're going to be speaking to Josh Rubiner in Washington, D.C. about U.S. presidential candidates, Democratic presidential candidates, and their shifting views on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and also aid, U.S. aid to Israel. So we'll be doing that. And your phone calls, you can call us at 813-239-9663. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Which city was that? True Talk on WMNF 88.5. I'm now joined with Josh Rubiner from Washington, D.C. He is, Josh, are you there?
Yes. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning, Josh. Maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit more because you've had so many roles in Washington.
Well, sure. Currently, I'm the senior principal of a full-service government affairs consulting agency. And before that, I worked as the policy director for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights and as a Middle East analyst for Congressional Research Service.
You've been covering the Middle East for quite some time, especially Israeli and Palestinian politics. And as you mentioned, you worked for an organization that was advocating for the rights of Palestinians. How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing that for about 20 years.
20 years, and you're an author of a book, or at least one book that I know of. What is the title?
Yes, Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace, and Israel, Democracy, or Apartheid State.
And at the time when you wrote this articles, or in your 20-year history, did you think that there would come a time when, as we're seeing now, that some Democrats are finally confronting or questioning military aid to Israel?
I did think that we would see a time, and I think it's become especially apparent over the last several years that there is a growing partisan division over U.S. policy toward Israel and the Palestinian people, with the base of the Democratic Party becoming more progressive, with its elected representatives becoming more progressive in many cases. So I don't think, while it was inevitable, I do think that the writing was on the wall for these type of developments to occur. And I don't think it can be overstated how important it is that we're seeing this debate break open within the primary field within the Democratic Party in 2019 and going into 2020.
Now, for those who are not familiar, some of our listeners are not familiar with the issue. How much aid is our government sending to Israel?
Under an agreement between the United States and Israel that was signed in the later days of the Obama administration, the United States committed to give Israel $38 billion in weapons over the next 10 years. Averages out to $3.8 billion a year, and it actually is more military aid to that one country than all other countries combined. The United States gives about 60% of its entire military aid budget just to Israel. And these weapons play a direct role in perpetuating Israel's prolonged military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, an occupation which has gone on now for more than half a century. And it makes the United States taxpayers directly complicit in Israel's brutalities and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, which are often committed directly with the assistance of these U.S. weapons.
When you say that the U.S. taxpayers are complicit, it's not like, do taxpayers decide how money is spent?
Well, indirectly we do, by the people who we elect to represent us in Congress, and it is members of Congress who make this decision to allocate this money to Israel on an annual basis. So yes, in a representative democracy, I would argue that U.S. taxpayers are indirectly complicit in these decisions, and we need to advocate for policy change with our elected representatives to change this atrocious policy.
Why should taxpayers care? I mean, they're so worried about their health care and so many other issues, trying to survive and make ends meet. Do you think that they actually, one, know about how their money is being misspent, and two, that they can do anything about it?
Well, I think that's a really critical question, and it's often claimed that we do not have the resources in this country to pay, for example, for Medicare for all. And I believe very strongly that a budget is a moral document as well as just a bunch of numbers written on paper. It expresses how we prioritize our spending, what issues our government is concerned about funding, and whether these are going to human needs as they should, or going to destroy human needs, as in the case of Israel's brutality toward the Palestinian people. And if you look at the overall discretionary funding of the U.S. government, that means all funding that goes towards all non-required payments. So the non-discretionary parts of the budget are things like Social Security and Medicare. But if you look at what's discretionary, what's up to Congress to actually spend, the majority of funding, more than all other components of the budget combined, go to support warfare in the United States. And that's atrocious. So I think it's very important that you see people like Senator Elizabeth Warren, in her proposal to enact Medicare for All, talk about reducing the need for endless warfare and funding endless warfare to help pay for those. So it's about our budgetary priorities. It's about our moral priorities as a country. And certainly the U.S. funding of Israel to the tune of billions of dollars each year is part of that issue.
Okay, before we get into the views of presidential candidates and how this is, you know, the question about Israel will come up in, or is coming up, and how they're addressing it in this campaign, just give us some historical background on this military aid and U.S. aid to Israel. You mentioned as far back as the most recent, aid package that was signed by Obama at the end of his term, $38 billion. Before that, Was that a huge jump, or how has it been in the past historically? When did it start? How much has been spent, if you have those figures, over, you know, since the establishment of Israel?
Since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, upon the ruins of Palestinian society, the United States has given Israel approximately $140 billion in military and economic assistance. In the early days, the numbers were very insignificant. Israel was treated as more like a charity case by the United States, where the vast majority of aid that it received was in things like excess supplies of wheat and agriculture that the United States would send to Israel. It wasn't until the Kennedy administration that the United States actually started to sell advanced weaponry to Israel. And really, up until the Nixon administration, the bulk of U.S. military and economic aid to Israel was in the form of loans, not grants. But things began to change starting in the Nixon administration and increasingly in every administration throughout, until during the Reagan years, the loan portion of the aid was reduced to nothing, and it was all in grants, all in taxpayer-funded grants to Israel. And since the Reagan administration, but most importantly, since the Clinton administration and the advent of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process in 1993, you've really seen a skyrocketing of U.S. military aid to Israel over the course of those last 25 years. So whereas during the Clinton administration, it was about $1.8 billion in military aid per year, you've now seen that more than double in the 2.5 decades since that time.
You mentioned that it really kicked up during the Nixon administration. What happened during Nixon that there was a shift to more aid, military aid towards Israel, even though it's now become commonly known that Nixon harbored some anti-Semitic views, at least in the tapes that have been released?
Yeah, no doubt. And there should be no doubt in anyone's mind that one can simultaneously be anti-Semitic and pro-Israel. And it sounds like a contradiction, but we see the exact same things playing out today in the white supremacy that is at the heart and the base of the Trump administration, and that I think animates its decisions as well. So during the Nixon administration, this was, of course, during, you know, one of the heights of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, Israel was perceived by the United States as a strategic asset in its global Cold War against the Soviet Union, much as apartheid South Africa fulfilled that same role for the United States in the southern part of the African continent in the 60s and 70s as well. So it was largely Cold War strategic considerations that propelled that drive to really arm Israel to the teeth.
Then you have during the Carter administration, when they brokered a peace deal between Israel and Egypt, and you know, at that time there was also aid going to Egypt for military aid, but it seemed like it was conditional or as a byproduct of the aid to Israel as well. So even though Egypt is getting military aid, the second highest recipient of military aid, but it was really to protect Israel's interests, specifically in the Sinai and in those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the main reasons why the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat signed the peace accords with Israel was to draw closer to the United States and bring it into the pro-U.S. camp in the Cold War. And one of the main rewards for him doing that was this huge amount of military aid that Egypt also receives. And I think it's important to note, too, that Israel is not the only recipient of U.S. aid that uses these weapons to commit human rights atrocities. We see the same process playing itself out in Egypt right now, where you have the regime of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi engaged in levels of brutality and oppression against the Egyptian people that were inconceivable even under the Mubarak reign. You know, the levels of repression that we're seeing right now against peaceful protests and forced disappearances, activists sitting in jail for years on end with no charges or trial in Egypt, torture, abductions, extrajudicial assassinations by the security forces in Egypt. All of that is with the help and assistance of USAID too. So the human rights abuses that are committed by U.S. weapons are not solely related to Israel. We see the same thing, for example, with the Saudi and UAE attack on Yemen, although it should be noted that those weapons are sold to those countries and not given to them free of charge, as is in the case with Egypt and Israel.
Yeah, so in the case of Egypt and Israel, they're getting it for free. In the case of the Saudis and the UAE, the Emiratis, they're paying for those weapons top dollar. And again, they're using, in a way, they're using their resources, petrodollars or oil, to purchase weapons and not necessarily assisting their own people. But let's go back. What happened and why the shift? I mean, how much of this was due to lobbies like AIPAC and, what is described as a lobby, this network of pro-Israel organizations in the United States funneling money? On one hand, AIPAC lobbying Congress. On the other hand, a network of PACs across the country that actually raise money for politicians.
It's a very important consideration into how this policy gets formulated and maintained. And whereas I would argue that AIPAC and the pro-Israel lobbies weren't so significant in the Nixon era, they've definitely gained in significance and relevance since then, getting especially strong beginning in the 1980s and onwards. So yes, you have organizations like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, whose primary responsibility is to guarantee this annual appropriation of military aid to Israel. And their advocacy for these weapons is always the primary consideration of their annual lobby days, which take place in Washington, D.C. in the spring, where they bring thousands of pro-Israel advocates to Capitol Hill to lobby for the continuation of this policy. And in recent years, we've seen this advocacy for weapons expand not only from AIPAC, which is really considered a right-wing and more or less pro-Republican organization at this point, but also to organizations like J Street, which are considered by some people to be more quote-unquote liberal, but are nevertheless advocating for these same exact policies from within a more democratic perspective.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to, this is True Talk on WMNF, we're speaking to Josh Rubner. He's based in Washington, D.C. He's been working on Israeli-Palestinian issues and policy for the past 20 years. He's author of two books, and he's also worked for the organization which is now called the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, a organization that's seeking equal rights for Palestinians. And you recently wrote this article, and he was just, I think, yesterday about in Mondo Ice, called "The Democrats Finally Confront Military Aid to Israel," and that's what we're talking about. Other than AIPAC, how big is this lobby or pro-Israel lobby in the United States? I mean, it's not only AIPAC that's involved.
No, there are dozens of political action committees that raise money to support politicians who will agree to sustain and implement this policy. It's very hard to quantify because there are so many organizations involved, so many different niches that they fulfill. But I would estimate that there are dozens, if not at least 100 organizations on the national scene and on the local scene that are supportive of these policies.
I mean, would this include even like, the Anti-Defamation League, which is seen as a prominent civil liberties or civil rights organization? It seems like they've become more and more of a pro-Israel lobby.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the ADL, its primary purpose right now is to police speech on Israel. And for many decades, they've had a very problematic record in this regard. trying to crack down on the free expression of U.S. citizens and residents in support of Palestinian rights. There are numerous examples of the ADL engaging in extremely sketchy behavior for a so-called civil rights organization, such as spying on the anti-apartheid movement back in the 1980s, because of the ties between the strong ties between the anti-apartheid movement and South African activists and Palestinian activists for liberation. And today, the ADL is dominated by a pro-Israel agenda. It definitely advocates both within Congress and toward successive administrations for pro-Israel policies. And I think even more importantly, seeks to delegitimize the voices of people who are advocating for Palestinian rights by falsely claiming that they're bigoted.
And that's the thing that they use against many politicians that, you know, and this is actually some states are now introducing this legislation that redefines anti-Semitism as criticism of Israeli policies, you know, even to the point that, for example, if you criticize Benjamin Netanyahu and his policies in Israel, that that's somehow anti-Semitism and it can get you in a lot of trouble.
It's an extremely dangerous development because we do have a real problem of anti-Semitism in this country. We do have a real problem of Islamophobia and hatred toward Muslims. We do have a real problem of white supremacy and institutionalized racism against people of color, immigrants, xenophobia, all of these things. And all of these factors and tendencies have been emboldened and empowered by the Trump administration, which is emblematic of all of these viewpoints. So we do have a very serious problem. I mean, we've had, over the course of the past year, white supremacists walk into two synagogues and kill a total of 13 Jewish worshipers. So we do have a very serious problem of anti-Semitism that needs to be addressed in this country. But these Israel advocacy organizations spending their time and their resources defaming people who advocate for Palestinian rights from a perspective of human rights and international law and progressivism, to me, is outrageous when you have this emboldened right-wing deadly anti-Semitism, which is the real threat to the Jewish community and to all non-white Christians in this country.
If you're just joining us, this is Truth Talk. I'm WMNF. We're speaking to Josh Rubner. He's based in Washington, D.C. And we're speaking about an article, and more than that, but mainly he's on, wanted to speak to him about an article he wrote where he says the Democrats are finally confronting military aid to Israel. So in your article, you're basically saying that despite this, strong, perception that existed for a very long time in Washington, D.C., that one should never and can never question a military aid, U.S. military aid to Israel, that that would be suicidal, that that would end one's career. But now you have the Democratic candidates who are running for office. Three out of the top four actually have made remarks where they're kind of raising some doubts, obviously some stronger than others. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a critical development. You have at the recent conference of J Street, which is this supposedly more liberal alternative to AIPAC, but which nevertheless...
But in reality, it is...
policies.
Yeah, sorry to cut you off, but they are more liberal, aren't they? They're not right-wing AIPAC. They're not for Netanyahu, necessarily.
No, that's true. They're definitely anti-Netanyahu, but they're for the continuation of Israel's separate and unequal rule over the Palestinian people. They're for the maintenance of Israel as a quote-unquote Jewish state that discriminates against non-Jewish citizens. They oppose Palestinian refugee rights, and they only support Palestinian statehood in a very limited sense, not in a true sovereign way where Palestinians would actually have a truly functioning state. So, you know, there's a lot of deception going on as to what J Street actually supports and what their image is, but that aside, their recent national conference provided a very important venue despite J Street's previous positions of refusing to examine the impact of military aid to Israel, in that it allowed presidential candidates like Bernie Sanders, like Elizabeth Warren, like Pete Buttigieg, to express the concerns that they have about military aid to Israel. So Senator Sanders talked about redirecting some of the $3.8 billion in military aid that we give to Israel in order to help out the humanitarian catastrophe that's occurring in the Gaza Strip as a result of Israel's illegal blockade.
Which is, huge, like to say, like, we're going to shift money from, you know, military aid to help out Palestinians, that was, you know, sent shockwaves.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a common sense idea. I mean, the very limited foreign assistance that the United States provides should absolutely go towards supporting human needs and human rights and not the other way around.
Not weapons, so, necessarily.
Not weapons. In my opinion, not weapons at all, because U.S. military aid in terms of weapons are often used to commit human rights abuses. This is not just the case in the Middle East, but if you look at the history of U.S. weapons flows to Central America and Latin America more broadly, you'll see the same pattern play out. But, you know, it was very important for these presidential candidates to talk about these issues at J Street and have a national stage to do that. And it really represented, I think, the first time ever in U.S. presidential election history where you now have candidates actively campaigning and supporting this idea. And I think it really can't be overstated how important this is, that there is a distinct possibility that the next president of the United States will enter the White House already having expressed concerns about U.S. military aid to Israel. And that opens up a lot of possibilities for policy change.
Okay, so you told us what Bernie Sanders said. What did Elizabeth Warren say?
So Senator Warren and Mayor Buttigieg both spoke in more general terms about the need not to have U.S. aid supporting Israeli steps toward annexation of the West Bank. It should be stated, however, that Israel has already annexed part of the Palestinian West Bank, East Jerusalem. It annexed East Jerusalem in 1967. It annexed the Syrian Golan Heights in the early 1980s, all without any response from the United States.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF. We're speaking to Josh Rubner. While he clears his throat, I want to just give you our phone number. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663, and our email is dj@wmnf.org. You can call in with your questions or email them to us, and we'll pose them to Josh Rubner. Go ahead, Josh.
And what I was going to say is that Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem and the Syrian Golan Heights with no repercussions from the United States created this dynamic where Israel believes that it can get away with annexing occupied territory in contravention of international law with there being no consequences. So while it's important for the candidates to stake out a claim right now that they will not support U.S. funding for Israel's annexation, it should also be recognized that Israel has not only taken these de facto annexation steps regarding East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, but it's also in effect annexed a lot of Palestinian West Bank territory already. It's just a question of when Israel is going to formally do it. So I don't think that the candidates should talk about if this happens. I think they should be talking about, because Israel is doing this de facto steps toward annexation right now of Palestinian territory, there has to be immediate consequences to head it off.
And now, historically, there have been some Republicans in the past that have questioned military aid to Israel and even threatened to stop it. So, I mean, why has the shift, you know, on Israel has swapped where now more Democrats are actually questioning this, and this has become a sacred thing within the Republican Party, this relationship, unbreakable relationship with Israel?
Not only have previous Republican presidents threatened U.S. aid to Israel, but they've actually cut it off. Eisenhower did it twice in response to Israeli aggression against Egypt, and also for diverting the Jordan River waters. Reagan did it twice as well, once for Israel bombing Iraq in 1981, and the other time for using cluster bombs against civilians in Lebanon. And the George Bush, the first George Bush administration, famously refused to extend loan guarantees until Israel stopped engaging in settlement expansion. So there is this history of the United States actually leveraging its power over Israel to induce changes in its behavior. And I think the reason why this occurred in the past, primarily with Republican presidents, is because Republicans traditionally have enjoyed this sense that they are, quote unquote, tougher on national security issues than Democrats and are therefore more able to get away with it. But as you mentioned, we have seen dramatic changes in public opinion over the past generation that no longer allow for this to be a policy consideration. So what I'm talking about is that in the annual reports of Pew, they often test for which party has more sympathy for Israel versus which party has more sympathy for the Palestinian people. And a generation ago, if you look at the results of this public opinion polling, there was no predictive power to how you would answer this based on your party affiliation. Democrats and Republicans equally supported Israel and equally disliked the Palestinian people. But over the past generation, you've seen a gradual shift where Republicans now almost wall to wall support Israel over the Palestinian people. And the Democratic Party is evenly split. And in fact, if you look at the liberal or progressive polling within the Democratic Party, there's now more like a 2-to-1 favorability for the Palestinians over Israel. So this points to dramatic shifts in public opinion, which embolden candidates and members of Congress, it should be said, to talk about these policies, to put forward ideas for change, and to feel that they're being supported by the people who are going to be electing them.
I have a caller, if we can just take this call from John from Port Richey. John, hey. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for the show. A couple things. First, has there ever been a bill introduced in Congress to restrict military aid or deny military aid to any countries that violate human rights? You know?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, there is conditionality on all U.S. military and economic assistance. So the Foreign Assistance Act is the law that governs all forms of U.S. foreign aid. And the Foreign Assistance Act states that no country is eligible for any form of U.S. assistance if they engage in a consistent pattern of gross violations of human rights. There are more specific laws that aim to advance human rights with how U.S. aid is used. So, for example, the Arms Export Control Act strictly limits the usage of U.S. weapons and restricts it to legitimate self-defense and internal security, along with a few other very limited uses. And then there's something called the Leahy Law, named after the senator from Vermont, Patrick Leahy, that cuts off military aid to any unit, specific unit of a military that engages in gross violation of human rights. So there is this conditionality imposed on all countries receiving U.S. aid. And in the case of Israel, there's currently a bill pending introduced by Representative Betty McCollum of Minnesota that would expand the Leahy Law to ensure that no U.S. aid is used to arrest, abuse, including torture, interrogate and imprison Palestinian children in Israel's separate and unequal military court system. Israel is the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes children in a military court system. And Representative McCollum's bill seeks to do away with any U.S. funding for that human rights violation. In Israel's separate and unequal military courts.
Did I lose you? Go ahead, John. You had a follow-up?
My follow-up question would be, then how does Israel get all this aid from the United States? Is there some sort of, like UN court that has to say that they're violating human rights laws for the United States to say, okay, we're going to cut off aid? I don't understand how they're... how they're still getting this aid with all the stuff that they're doing. And the other thing I'd like to say, too, is I'd also like to see a debate between a Palestinian side and the Jewish side on the Jewish show on the apartheid conditions in Palestine.
Okay, thank you, John. Josh?
Yeah, those are points. I'm getting feedback.
Oh, you are? Okay, you have feedback right now.
Yes, it's still looping back through your friends.
Oh. Okay. Stand by. We'll be right back while we fix this loop back. But you shouldn't be getting loop back right now, right?
Let me try again. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you great.
Okay.
How is it right now?
It's okay. The caller made important points.
Yeah.
The deliberations are internal to the United States. So if the Department of State certifies and recognizes that Israel has violated one or more of these laws, then under U.S. law, the State Department is supposed to make the determination to apply the appropriate sanction for the law's violation. So what we have here is not a failure of the UN to document these human rights abuses. It does so copiously. What we have is a failure of political will of the Department of State and members of Congress to insist that the Department of State find Israel to be in violation of these laws. And, to the last point, I would just say that, there is no one particular Jewish perspective on this issue. There are Jewish people who support Israel's human rights abuses of the Palestinian people, and there are Jewish people who oppose Israel's separate and unequal rule over the Palestinian people as well, including among Israeli Jews.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5. We're speaking with Josh Rubner from Washington, D.C. He's been working on Palestinian-Israel policy in Washington in different capacities for the past 20 years. And he recently wrote an article about how presidential candidates on the Democratic side are questioning or raising questions about U.S. military aid to Israel. What do you attribute the change? In your article, you mentioned there was three things mainly that are causing this shift where presidential candidates are finally questioning this, something that they... we thought would not be questioned.
Yeah, number one, Palestinian rights advocacy organizations have been demanding this for decades. And it's often the case that in processes of social change, this type of work happens over a long period of time, that the seeds are planted for a long period of time before they're harvested. So I think that what we're seeing now is recognition amongst some of the progressive base of the Democratic Party that what these Palestinian rights organizations have been saying all along is true and needs to be acted on. So that's the first factor. The second factor is the fact that you've seen in recent years, especially in the 2018 midterms, a huge shift toward progressivism within the Democratic Party. And looking at who is getting elected to Congress from this progressive wave, I think explains to a large degree why you're seeing this push now within the Democratic Party, because you have three first-term members of Congress, Representatives Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are all on record making very strong statements opposing U.S. aid to Israel. And it's no secret that these three representatives are seen as the future of the Democratic Party. Plus, you have people like Representative Betty McCollum pushing these bills legislatively to get some traction on these issues. So you have the beginnings of an emergence of an informal caucus in Congress amongst only Democrats, it should be said, that is willing to take a second look at this policy. And then third is, you know, what we alluded to earlier with these dramatic changes in public opinion, where Israel and the Palestinian people has suddenly become a partisan issue. So in 2016, for example, you saw the Republicans dramatically change their platform regarding this issue. George W. Bush was a president who advocated for the establishment of a Palestinian state. Not that he did anything to actually bring about that reality, but he at least advocated for it rhetorically. And since that time, every single Republican platform supported Palestinian statehood. In 2016, the Republicans took out their support for Palestinian statehood and also expressed an extremely controversial and ill-informed opinion that Israel was not engaged in a military occupation. So you have Republicans denying reality when it comes to Israel and the Palestinian people, whereas on the Democratic side, you've seen this debate play out very, very publicly in the 2016 election between Bernie Sanders delegates and Hillary Clinton delegates to the Democratic National Convention, and where there was a real fight. Mm-hmm. There was a real fight over the platform language to include recognition of Israel's illegal settlements, illegal military occupation. That was defeated by the Clinton wing of the party. But that wing of the party, I think, has really become a dinosaur over the past 4 years. I mean, things have changed so dramatically since then.
I was a delegate to that convention in Philadelphia and, you know, representing my district here in Florida. And I happened to be a delegate for Bernie Sanders. So I saw firsthand, you know, the two camps. Within, you know, the convention itself, within the delegates and within the party, and the big divide, and the sentiments when, there were sometimes people were booing when certain statements were made about Israel that did not line up with the progressive values of the party, and more so even than the previous convention when I attended in North Carolina. And, there were some boos there, too. When I forgot who the congressman was, or a former congressman now, Wexler, I guess, he had come up to the microphone and spoke during the convention about the special relationship with Israel. And even then, in 2012, people were raising Palestinian flags or saying, you know, Palestinian rights. But there were definitely a lot more, and it seemed like, you know, it was a lot more organized. Even, you know, in the Florida delegation, the Israeli or the Palestinian flag was raised, which caused some commotion. So there is that shift, that's noticeable within the grassroots, but now it's actually reaching, the candidates as they become more progressive. I'm going to go to another phone call. Our phone number, by the way, is 813-239-9663. John from St. Petersburg, Florida, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I have a question of, I'm a Democrat, but I don't understand why it is that if you criticize Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Every time I hear anybody that criticizes Israel is called anti-Semitic. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's a clear strategy by Israel's supporters to try to delegitimize those voices calling for Palestinian rights. And, you know, it's unfortunate that in the past and in the present situation, there have been some white supremacists who truly are anti-Semitic, who wrap themselves up in the Palestinian flag figuratively because they hate Jewish people. But 99.9% of people who advocate for Palestinian rights in this country do not come at it from that viewpoint. So it's unfair to tarnish all of them with the actions of a few undesirables.
But is it a preemptive way to shut down any discussion or even raise the issue?
Well, absolutely, because no one likes to be called a racist. No one likes to be called a bigot. Most people don't see themselves as that, regardless of views that they may or may not hold. But no one likes to be called that. And certainly with the devastating history of anti-Semitism throughout the centuries, no rational person would want to be tarred by that accusations. So yes, it is a way of shutting down debate. But as I mentioned before, it's really, I think, incredibly disturbing when you have this right-wing white supremacist actual anti-Semitism taking place to go after good-hearted people who are coming at this from the perspective of human rights and international law and advocating for these type of positions across the board.
Betty writes in an email, great show. Israel and Egypt got billions from the U.S. to keep their cult peace. Neither country is truly democratic, although Israel, despite its lousy record on Palestine or Palestinians, is more progressive and open society. Both countries should get far less and should have to answer to their human rights abuses. And that sentiment is there, but, you know, like you said, what can, for example, I mean, to the point about people criticizing Israel are not anti-Semitic at all. Many of the people that I know that advocate for Palestinian rights and criticize Israel's record are Jewish people. If I'm not mistaken, I think you're also Jewish. Are you?
That's correct.
Okay. So how is it as a Jewish person and at the same time, I mean, do you get any type of blowback or pushback from people within your own family or your community because you're advocating for what could be perceived the enemy of Jews, which is obviously a misperception?
I think that that was a much more strong force a generation ago. Today, I think that that power to compel unanimity within the Jewish community is greatly diminished. I think that when you look at public opinion polling of young people in the United States in general and within the Jewish American community in particular, you see a move toward progressivism, away from unblinking, unthinking nationalist sentiments, a willing to criticize human rights records and atrocities. And so, you know, as we see this generational shift play out within the Democratic Party, you're also seeing it play out within the Jewish American community. And I don't think it's a coincidence at all that an organization like Jewish Voice for Peace, which advocates for Palestinian rights and a just and lasting peace, is the fastest growing Jewish American organization in the country. I don't think it's a coincidence that you have organizations like If Not Now, which is composed of young Jewish Americans, really getting in the face of candidates about Palestinian rights and ending Israeli military occupation. So I think that that consideration of people facing pressure not to speak out, not to air dirty laundry in public, I think for the most part, that's a thing of the past. I think where you have intense governmental and societal repression is on Palestinian Americans who are speaking out on behalf of their people and on behalf of their rights. We've seen so many prosecutions of Palestinian Americans and organizations that represent Palestinian Americans, so many efforts to try to strip Palestinian Americans of their agency to speak out on this issue in the United States. I think that's the real danger. And I think that Palestinian Americans should be able to continue to feel emboldened and empowered to speak out on their own behalf and not have Jewish Americans, speak for them.
Josh Rubner, thank you for joining us on True Talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Ahmed.
That was Josh Rubner. If you missed the episode, you can catch it on iTunes or any podcast platform you're using. Just look for True Talk Radio Show. NPR News is next.